Welcome to the UK and World News Channel on Orbio, powered by Audioboom. In this show, the first major deal from the Chinese Premier's visit to the UK. It's the day Marty McFly arrives in 2015 from Back to the Future. The internet has obviously gone wild. And Harry Styles speaks after One Direction were forced to cancel their gig in Belfast. First, the latest global headlines from the AP newsroom.
AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. Fractious Republicans will vote next week on a new House Speaker. That's what we're hearing. Speaker John Boehner has set the date for next Wednesday. House Republicans will select their candidate for Speaker, and the full House will choose a new Speaker to replace John Boehner on Thursday. This word comes a day after Republican Congressman Paul Ryan said he is now open to the job if Republicans unify behind him.
If you can agree to these requests, and if I can truly be a unifying figure, then I will gladly serve. And if I'm not unifying, that will be fine as well. I'll be happy to stay where I am at the Ways and Means Committee.
The Russians say they will meet with Secretary of State John Kerry in Vienna to talk about the crisis in Syria. The Saudis and the Turks will be there, too. This word comes as Syrian President Assad pays a surprise visit to Moscow and President Putin. AP correspondent Anita Chang is overseas.
Putin has thanked Assad for accepting the invitation to go to Moscow, and both leaders are saying that the military actions are a prelude to what must be a political situation.
Russia began carrying out airstrikes on Islamic State militants in Syria last month in support of President Assad's troops. We're learning that in the European Union, that's 28 countries, Volkswagen has stopped sales of the remaining new cars that contain that diesel engine fitted with the software that was used to cheat on U.S. emissions tests. And here at home in St. Louis, police are increasing patrols in mostly black neighborhoods where several suspicious fires have damaged six churches. Police say they're developing profiles of possible suspects. This is AP Radio News. Police aren't saying much about an incident in South Florida early Sunday morning in which a black man was shot dead by a police officer. Palm Beach Gardens Police Chief Stephen Stepp says an on-duty officer in plain clothes driving an unmarked police vehicle spotted what he thought was an abandoned car.
As the officer exited his vehicle, he was suddenly confronted by an armed subject. As a result of the confrontation, the officer discharged his firearm, resulting in the death of Mr. Corey Jones.
Friends say Jones was having car trouble as he drove home on Interstate 95 from an appearance with his band. His family's hired civil rights attorneys as the police department investigates. A man's under arrest in Detroit after he slashed two EMTs who were trying to help the injured woman he was with, according to police. The EMTs were seriously injured but are expected to recover. Rita Foley, AP Radio News.
As the Chinese Premier Xi Jinping continues his tour in the UK, EDF Energy has reached an agreement with China's CGN to build a new nuclear power plant at Hinkley Point in Somerset. Audioboom News reporter Louisa Jackson has the story.
EDF Energy's reached an agreement with China's CGN to build a new nuclear power plant at Hinkley Point in Somerset. The announcement was made as the Chinese President Xi Jinping continued his four-day visit to the UK. The deal's part of a raft of agreements the government hopes will amount to around £30 billion. It's expected the plant, the first to be built in a generation in the UK, could be open as soon as 2025. It also sets up a wider UK partnership to develop new nuclear power stations at Sizewell and Bradwell.
It's Back to the Future Day, and Marty McFly has arrived in the future. Yes, he's here, but obviously hoverboards aren't. The internet's gone wild, and KSL News has found a DeLorean with a real, actual flux capacitor.
Dr. Jay Shetland likes to work on old cars. One day he was watching Back to the Future with his kids and thought, maybe it's time to work on a DeLorean.
They were a decent car back in the day. I mean, they were 90% awesome parts, 10% junk, unfortunately.
He says every time he drives it, it's a conversation starter.
One of the first questions everybody asks is, does that come with a flux capacitor?
By the way, yes it does. He found one on eBay. He says he found a buyer willing to pay $42,000 for this car, but before he sells it, he's taking it to the Megaplex at the District today as part of a Back to the Future fundraiser for MS. Paul Nelson, KSL News Radio.
One Direction were forced to cancel their gig in Belfast last night after Liam Payne fell ill. Here is Harry Styles speaking to BBC Radio 4 about the cancellation.
He's okay. He's okay. He was trying to get well, right? And he was just very, very ill. It's just, to be honest, we feel kind of lucky that we've got to this point and never cancelled one. So obviously we're all very disappointed and, you know, very, very much apologise to everyone who was there.
And discussing the latest news, here is the Pacey The Briefing from London's Midori House and Monocle 24.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 21st of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Marcus Hippi. Coming up in the programme, a surprise visit. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has flown to Moscow to thank Russian President Vladimir Putin personally for his military support in Syria. But how worried should the West be with this renewed friendship? We'll have the analysis. Then we'll look at to which extent there is still a left-wing voice left in Israel amid the current unrest.
There is, I think, a misperception in this country of what left really means. People who consider themselves to be left, voters for, say, the Labour Party, they consider themselves to be left. But in fact, these nationalist parties, I don't consider them left.
Also ahead, the publisher Pearson sees its shares dropping over 16% despite the recent sale of the Financial Times and its stake on The Economist. We discuss the challenges the education publisher is currently facing. And finally on today's programme, we look at what Apple has up its sleeve regarding the car industry. All that's right here on The Briefing with me, Marcus Hippi. So once again, we have a busy show ahead. Let's start today with a look at the North American papers. Monocle's executive editor, Steve Bloomfield, is now in the studio with me. Welcome to the programme. How are you doing today?
I'm very good, Marcus. Very good indeed. Shall we begin with Canada?
Let's do that.
Okay, so as you can imagine, there is one... Rather large story dominating the front pages in Canada. A new Trudeau era, says the front of the National Post, because, of course, Justin Trudeau, the new, well, Prime Minister designate, as he technically is so far, is not the first Trudeau to be Prime Minister. That is also actually mentioned, incidentally, in the New York Times. Its profile of Trudeau is headlined Back Where He Was Born, because, of course, he was born in 24 Sussex Drive, which is where the Prime Minister's official residence in Ottawa. The National Post has a big picture of him meeting voters back in his constituency, or riding, as they call it. They also have some analysis on what went wrong for the Conservatives. I must say, a slightly confusing skyline at the top of the National Post there. At the top it says Financial Post, anti-oil movement left on the fringe with Liberal win.
Uh-huh.
But right underneath Financial Post, it says, in pretty much the same font, it says crushed, which is referring to the Blue Jays losing 14-2. At first glance, I was like, oh, Financial Post is crushed.
That's surprising news. Anyway. But anyway, Trudeau is interesting. There, if you look at those North American papers, he's all over. I think he's quite a refreshing character, something different as a politician.
Yes, yeah, certainly he is. I think it's fair to say he's been Googled more by people in this office than Stephen Harper was. Let's put it that way. Trudeau wastes no time getting to work, says Toronto Star. Tells US President, we'll pull our fighter jets from fight against Islamic State in Iraq, Syria. This is referring to his phone call with Barack Obama, where he said, yes, we will be, Canada will be pulling its jets out of the battle with ISIS, which is one of his campaign pledges. If we go to the news New York Times, I say, they've got a bit on Trudeau. They also have a good piece by Eric Schmidt and Matthew Rosenberg looking at the American airstrike against the MSF hospital in Kunduz. Hospital strike fueled by units new to Kunduz, unfamiliar terrain for Afghans and GIs. That is a piece. Interestingly, this piece written in Washington, not in Afghanistan. They have basically seemed to have... They've been speaking to people who are sort of close to what's happening in the Pentagon. How accurate that is so far, we don't know.
That's what's making headlines today on the North American front pages. Thank you very much, Steve. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Just 5 minutes past the hour. We start today with what is quite a surprise visit. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has flown to Moscow to personally thank Russia's President Vladimir Putin for his military support. This is Assad's first foreign trip since the outbreak of the Syrian crisis in 2011, and it comes 3 weeks after Russia launched a campaign of airstrikes against Islamist militants in Syria that has also bolstered Assad's forces. Joining me on the line to tell us about the possible discussion topics in the Kremlin is Fawaz Jerzes, Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics. Welcome to the programme. What do you think what has been discussed today?
Well, first of all, Assad was summoned to Moscow to meet with Putin. This was not a regular visit. Putin made it very clear that he basically called on Assad to come to Russia and meet with the Russian leadership. Of course, according to both sides, military coordination and also the question of a political settlement in the midterm, because they obviously, both sides appreciate that regardless of how much military might you might throw on the battlefield, you need to think of a political transition. So two basic elements. First, the so-called the fight against terrorism, as both sides call it. And secondly, Putin has made it very clear he would be doing his best to help broker a political settlement, which it seems to be really far indeed at this particular point.
Well, when I use the word surprising, two things. First of all, it obviously wasn't announced beforehand. And secondly, this is indeed Assad's first trip abroad since 2011. Why was it so important for him to go and to meet President Putin personally, considering that Russia has already been operating in Syria? Can't these things be discussed, say, on the phone or through other means?
Well, I think the recent military surge by Russia is very qualitatively different from its previous efforts to help the Syrian regime. There is consensus in the region and outside the region that without Russian intervention, recent intervention, that basically the Syrian regime was on the brink of tatters, that basically was strategically very undermined by the recent military setbacks. Secondly, I think Russia's prestige is online. Russia has to make sure that Assad is online, that on the same page, that Russia responds to, that Assad responds to Russian wishes. And thirdly, and most importantly, I think this is basically Putin's stage. Putin now is flexing his muscle, displaying his power on the global stage, summoning Assad to Russia, saying, I have many cards to play, proposing to help in brokering a political settlement. So he has, multiple messages sent to the Russian people and also the international community as well.
Well, this visit indeed makes it clear how good friends Russia and al-Assad are at the moment. What do you think, what would be the healthiest, the best attitude for, say, NATO to take looking at this situation now and looking at how Russia and al-Assad are keeping it together?
Well, the reality is the recent Russian surge in Syria is really a game changer. These are not my words. These are according to the top NATO and European Union officials. The reality is neither NATO nor the United States has the will or the desire to intervene militarily in Syria. And that's why Putin has the stage for himself. What the United States and NATO can do is to make life very miserable for Putin in Syria, and we are already seeing the writing on the wall. More qualitative weapons are being sent to the opposition. More tanks, Syrian tanks, are being destroyed. Syria is turning into a war by proxy between Russia and the United States and the regional powers. At the end of the day, the Americans and the European leaders and even the Russian leaders realize the only way out for all sides concerned is a political transition, is a political settlement. The critical and most pivotal question is the future of Assad. Even though Russia says that they did not discuss with Assad the future of Assad, I doubt it very much that the Russian leadership is not thinking about the future of Assad. This is the reality. Everyone knows it. How long Assad will be in power in the transitional period, 6 months, as the Turks say, 8 months, 9 months. This is really the most pivotal question that's being discussed by regional powers, and I would say also by the Western powers and the Russian leadership as well.
You mentioned there that Russia has the will to intervene in Syria. How much more could Russia do in Syria if it wanted to?
I doubt it very much whether Russia would become embroiled in a ground operation. They had been burned before in Afghanistan. They realized a ground operation in Syria would be very reckless and costly. But so far, what's really surprising is that Russia has been willing to commit strategic forces in the support of Assad. Russia has put its own prestige online. We have been wrong before about the Russian willingness to support Assad. And I think this is not just about Syria and Assad. I think this is about Russia and the United States. That the struggle is not just about Syria, it's about the Ukraine and the leadership of the international system. And again, Putin now is asserting his power, not only in the Middle East, but also on the global stage. And this is why it makes the situation in Syria very complex and difficult to predict indeed.
That was Vawas Zerzhes, Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics. Thank you very much. You are with The Briefing on Monocle 24. It is 12:11 here in London, 7:11 a.m. in Washington, D.C. At the same time as what is being dubbed as the Third Intifada continues across Israel and the Palestinian territories, Israel's political landscape has been shifting to the right. The question many may be asking is to which extent there still is a left-wing voice left in the country. We're joined now by the journalist Imogen Kimber, who attended a protest in Jerusalem, the center of the violence, organized by both Arab and Jewish Israelis. Welcome to the program. Could you start by telling us about the protest and the initiative behind it?
So the protest was against the current state of violence, but also on a larger level against the occupation as a whole. And they see that the only way to stop the violence at the moment is to stop this cycle of violence and to stop the occupation, which is causing this current uprising. But also a really important point is that this is a joint initiative called Stand Together that, as you said, is both Arabs and Jews. And they really wanted to use this protest as a way of visualizing that Jews and Arabs have to stand together if this is going to end. So I spoke to Nimrod Flaschenberg, he was the organizer of the protest, and he described to me why this is so important.
Well, obviously there has been a decline in the past 20 years since Oslo and since the death of Rabin and so on, but I think that the past few years have really made it clear that a real left cannot be this Zionist disengagement from the Palestinians. We need to distance ourselves from the Palestinians because they are making all of the trouble, but a Jewish Arab left that understands that some of the main issues of Zionism are problematic for the Palestinian people here, and that only a joint struggle, which is a real left-wing struggle, can achieve both a peace compromise and also social justice.
So Imogen, what is your conclusion then about what's going on in the country? Is there a strong left wing in Israel still?
Okay, so that's a really interesting question. There's definitely a strong radical left, and there always has been, but that's an incredibly small minority. Whether there's still a left is an interesting question, because some people say that there hasn't really actually ever been a left. Another person I spoke to at the protest was Uriel Simonson, who's a lecturer from the Haifa University, and he told me his opinion about the lack of the left in Israel.
There is, I think, a misperception in this country of what left really means. People who consider themselves to be left, voters for, say, the Labour Party, they consider themselves to be left, but in fact these nationalist parties, I don't consider them left. Many times they're in favor of liberal economy and privatization, so that's part of the game. And as far as they see the solution with the Palestinians, there's, I think, very little willingness to go a dramatic step forward. They talk about territorial compromise, but they're not willing to see Jerusalem, for instance, East Jerusalem, given to the Palestinians.
So that was Uriel Simonson, lecturer in early Islamic studies at Haifa University. What do you think about what he said about the lack of will?
It sounds to be true. People are talking about a shift also to the right. But some people think that that's something that's only happened over the last 2 years with the Netanyahu government. But actually, that's been something that's been coming for over the past 20 years, that you can see. And that has... the reflection on the lack of mainstream left that can put any opposition up to this.
What is your take then? Do you think the mainstream is actually right, and is this a recent shift that we've been seeing in the country?
So for example, when I was at this protest in Jerusalem, which of course is known to be right-wing, but the protest of course needed police protection, and during that time there were several instances that were very tense. There was a small group of right-wing men that were trying to provoke the protest as it happened, and the police were constantly restraining them. I spoke to a woman, for example, on the side. She was shocked that the protest was even allowed to take place, actually, and said, as you mentioned, that she feels the mainstream is right and that that is exactly how they should be. I also spoke to Matan Cohen, who's a foreign relations advisor to the Hadash party, and he talked about how the people that you would be expecting to stand up for the left themselves are leading the right.
Sadly, as we saw recently, Labour Party leader Herzog actually bypassed Netanyahu from the right, calling to impose complete curfew over the occupied territories and so on. And therefore, I think what we've seen is that the radical left has become more organized, more active, and has stayed on point and on message, while the center, as it were, center left, has sort of dwindled and became irrelevant at best and part of the problem at worst.
And finally, Imogen, after that view, my final question for you, what do you think, is there any hope for change among the left wing then?
Well, look, to be honest, I mean, this reflects many of the people said as well. They think it's important to turn up, they need to make this, they need to show that they're against this, but people aren't really expecting to see a left wing style change, because there just isn't any evidence of any so far. And this recent violence at the moment shows that. It's not showing any signs of dwindling, and the response is not showing any signs of making changes that would stop it happening in the future. So that's a pretty negative outlook, I have to say.
That was Imogen Kimber, Monocle's contributor in Jerusalem. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Up next, we turn to the world of media. Stay tuned. It is 18 minutes past the hour. You are listening to The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. Let's continue now with a look at the British publisher Pearson, which seems to be on track to suffer its biggest share price fall since 1987. Shares dived as much as 16% after the company warned that its full-year earnings would be at the low end of expectations. The company is now in the process of selling off the Financial Times and its stake in The Economist. Pearson has blamed the profits warning on challenging market conditions. Well, joining me now for more is Henry Manns, media correspondent at the Financial Times. Welcome to the programme. What do you think? What are those challenging market conditions exactly?
Well, Pearson has been undergoing a shift for the last couple of years, and it's been saying that there's real change in the education market. So we've got a big move from printed materials to digital, and it's done a restructuring program to help that. But there are also sort of more short-term factors in the US. Typically, when the jobs market gets better, fewer people enroll in higher education, and it's pointing to those kind of short-term factors as something that's difficult to manage for a company that's so invested in education.
So what I'm wondering at the moment is that we get this news now, and considering that many schools are starting their terms, one would imagine that more books are being sold at this time of the year.
Yeah, this is a really key period for Pearson, beginning of the school year. It's when a lot of its business is done. And one of the things it said is that in North America, it sold fewer books than it expected to students, so more books coming back from bookstores unsold. And that plays into a debate amongst people who look at the company, some of them who say, look, this is a short-term problem, and it will go away when the economy fully picks up and when we're a few years into a stronger market. And those who say, actually, education will be like other media sectors. It will get disrupted and people will move to printed materials, and they'll pay less, and they'll pay less to traditional providers like Pearson, which is very strong in the textbook market.
To which extent is school books market related or dependent on the financial economic situation in each country? One could imagine that, you know, economic situation doesn't really affect education that much.
It's not just economics, it's also politics. In the US, there's been a debate around Common Core and the federally backed new standards that were intended to be rolled out nationwide, and various states have objected to that. One of the things that Pearson said today, I mean, it's a very global business, is that the South African business isn't doing very well. And people might say, well, why is that? The answer is that South Africa had a general election in 2014. It sold a lot of books just before, or the government bought a lot of books just before that election, and then hasn't bought so many since. So it's those kind of factors which make Pearson, which is the world's largest education company by revenues, quite a difficult beast for analysts to judge, really. There's so many factors going on worldwide.
Henry, what do you think? What does it take for Pearson to actually recover from this?
The stock market is probably best left to other people. I think what Pearson will come out and say is, look, in 2013 and 2014, we tried to really reshape the company in a very rapid amount of time, and they'll be trying to push a message that they now have products that can grow, and that they're now less exposed to shipping books from warehouses to bookstores, and more about services, about running schools, about providing whole learning systems that teachers and students can use in what is a very digitally connected age.
That was Henry Manns, media correspondent for the Financial Times. Thank you very much. It's 20:22 in Tokyo, 14:22 in Moscow, 12:22 here in London, and 7:22 a.m. in New York City. Finally, on today's edition of The Briefing, it's time to have a look at the world of technology, more specifically Apple and some news regarding cars. And who else talked to us about that than Monocle's technology correspondent, David Phelan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, interesting news. Tim Cook spoke on Monday about many things Apple-related, and he was offering some hints about cars. What do you think is going on over there now?
It's always very difficult to read. It's like reading runes. They give you a hint, but they won't say anything. I think he was specifically directly asked, what about cars? And his response was something like, have you been drinking too much? Everyone knows they won't give a thing away. But he did say that he thought the focus on the combustion engine vehicle was going to change. And he also said that he wanted to give, whatever this means, everyone an iPhone experience in the car. They already do that with CarPlay, where there's a display that you can have that has the same apps, same icons that you get on an iPhone. If you want to make a phone call in your car, or use the sat nav, or play music, so that they're trying to integrate the Apple experience into cars already. So that's the first thing. But They clearly want to go further. They've been testing cars, we know this, in a place called the Gomentum Station, which is a former naval base in California. We know they've been there, and it's a place that other car companies, such as Honda and Mercedes-Benz, have been trying out driverless cars. We don't know if that's what Apple has been done. But we also know that they leased a car that was seen driving around California with cameras all over it. Mm-hmm. That could have been for Apple Maps, or it could have been the first stage towards a driverless car.
So, for example, let's look at possible ambitions of Apple to actually delve into the industry of driverless cars. It takes a lot of expertise and research. Having been at IAA Motor Show in Frankfurt, for example, speaking to experts from different car manufacturers, they all have been doing research for years and years and years, and they've been trying to create that technology. Would you imagine that Apple all of a sudden could just come up with something that would work equally well?
No, I completely agree. I think my gut feeling, nobody knows, but my gut feeling is they're not going to build a car, but they will build the software that will make using a car, whether it's with a driver or driverless, easier. With a driverless car, you have to have amazingly detailed maps, incredibly detailed. They're very expensive to make. Google is making them now so that it can create driverless cars. And you also have to have amazing cameras, very fast technology, incredibly reliable technology so that the car doesn't... We all know how reliable GPS can be in giving us instructions to go the wrong way down a one-way street. All those things have to be solved. So it's a major thing. There's a rumour that it will, whatever Apple is doing will be on the roads in 2019. Well, we'll know considerably before that because testing and regulation take so long.
So it sounds like this would be something along the lines of collaborating with different car manufacturers, if I understand that correctly. Do we know about anything like that happening already? Do we know if Apple has anything to do with any car makers at the moment?
Yeah, sure. CarPlay, this in-car version of the iPhone software, is already available and is... I think most car manufacturers have now said that they will or could make it, and it is available now in some cars already. So they definitely do have strong relationships with them. Whether that's enough, I don't know. There was rumours they might buy Tesla a year ago. I don't think they're going to do that. But that would certainly give them a way of having great expertise in car manufacture.
Well, besides autonomous driving, what else could you do? Could you imagine Apple doing regarding cars?
I think, as well as autonomous driving, you know, the great thing about Apple is user experience. The iPod wasn't the first MP3 player, but it was the easy one. iPhones changed the way we use smartphones. And this is what Tim Cook seems to be saying, there is a big change coming in the way that we use our cars, then Apple is for sure going to be in the right place to make that happen.
Could you imagine some examples of what we may be doing with our phones or even without phones to get that experience?
Certainly integration is the first thing that you will, even now you can tap on the phone icon and you don't have to think about whether you're making a phone call on your phone or whether, and of course voice interaction, they have their own version called Siri, is a big part of that, so that you don't have to take your hands off the steering wheel. You can say, "Hey Siri, call mum," or "play this track," or "direct me to whatever." That's already happening quite a lot with the iPhone, but the idea is you'll keep your hands on the steering wheel while that happens.
Well, you've been obviously following what Apple does for quite some time, and as you mentioned earlier, it's been said that we could see this new car technology, these cars, possibly already in 2019. Yeah. When will we find out more if that is indeed what is going to happen?
If that's the case, we should know in about 2017. The regulation, the testing, it takes a lot of time. And one thing Apple cannot bear is someone else sharing their secrets. So they would rather share them publicly than the day before they hand the car over to be regulated and tested.
Who are Apple's competitors now when we look at what's happening over here?
In terms of cars, if that's some that we deal, deem that that's what Apple is doing, then certainly Google is absolutely at the forefront. You need amazing mapping. The companies that have that amazing mapping are Google, Navtel, and Teleatlas. Teleatlas is owned by TomTom, and they don't want to make cars. But Google has already made some driverless cars. It's a curious thing because they don't have steering wheels in them, so that you are just a passenger. So what happens when things do go wrong?
And do you think people are ready to adapt into that technology? Do you think people actually want to get that kind of a driverless experience that they just let the thing drive? And
well, it's, I think that is the biggest challenge of all, more than the technology, that we all know our phones crash, our computers crash, all these things blunder, and well, regular cars do as well, but you don't kind of feel that it's going to suddenly career off the road and take you somewhere that you don't want to go.
That was Monocle's technology correspondent, David Phelan. Thank you very much. And that's already all for this edition of The Briefing here in London. The programme was produced by Carlo Tarabello and researched by Gaia Lutz, Ines Fresine and Federica Romaniello. Our studio manager was Wei Donglin. For the next half hour, Gillian Tobias is in the studio. She's bringing you the best music from our international playlist. This programme, The Briefing, is back tomorrow at the same time. I am Markus Hippi. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
You've been listening to the UK and World News Channel on Orpio, powered by Audioboom.